Alan Zweibel is one of my favorite people on this planet. He started his career selling jokes for $7 a piece to the last of the Borscht Belt stand-ups. Then one night, despite bombing on stage, he caught the attention of Lorne Michaels and became one of the first writers at Saturday Night Live, where he penned classic material for Gilda Radner, John Belushi, and all of the original Not Ready for Primetime players. From SNL, Zweibel then went on to have a hand in a series of landmark shows, from It's Gary Shandling Show to Curb Your Enthusiasm. In his new book, Laugh Lines, he weaves together the stories of his influential career, from writing for a generation of Jackies and Mortys and Dickies to meeting Gilda while hiding behind a potted plant. More on that later. His latest film collaboration, Here Today, starring Billy Crystal and Tiffany Haddish, will be in theaters tomorrow. Alan is the co-producer. The screenplay for Here Today was co-written by Crystal and Alan, inspired by his short story entitled The Prize. It is a great pleasure to welcome Alan Zweibel to the roundtable this morning. Alan, how are
you? How you doing?
I'm good. I'm really good. You know, I realized as I was reading your book and preparing that I don't think I could be wrong on this, but I don't think the last time I had you on was like 5 books ago. So it's really good to have you here, and I appreciate you coming back.
It's my 5 books ago. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I wish it had been sooner, but I'm glad you're here now. So I love this book so much. This is just a great story, and I want to just key on the subtitle: My Life Helping Funny People Be Funnier. So at what point did you start to think of your life as being that?
Well, you know, something very early on. I mean, even when I was writing for those comics up in the Catskills, you know, I never had a desire, never, to be a performer. And I just like writing too much. And then I, you know, writing for those Catskill guys, and then when I got to SNL and all the other stuff, you know, the collaboration with the people I've been fortunate enough to collaborate with, Gilda and Gary Shandling and Martin Short and Larry David and Dave Barry, I've been really fortunate that way. And, you know, the collaboration, writing is such a lonely thing to do. If you can collaborate with somebody, there's a synergy there where 1 and 1 equals 3, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, once I started writing and I trained my ear to listen to and capture the voices of the people I was writing for or the characters I was creating, it became that much easier.
You do a cool thing in the book. You seem to keep all of your rejection letters. I don't know of all of them, but you keep a lot of them.
So I have a folder here that's maybe 2 inches thick. That's a lot of paper.
Yeah.
That's a lot of rejection letters. It started off in the 70s when I was in college, when I would send unsolicited material to Mad Magazine. My God, there must be an inch of rejections just from Mad Magazine. But the Tonight Show, the Dick Cavett Show, the Carol Burnett Show, all the variety shows that were on the air, I would send them from my dorm room in college. And after I graduated, I kept submitting unsolicited material, and they were answered by rejection letters. And I remember back then, the big accomplishment was if the rejection letter wasn't a formed letter. Okay. So somebody said, if somebody personalized it, you know, and said, Alan, not bad, but this isn't for us. That to me was a major victory, as opposed to the generic one they sent to everybody.
You print this one from Mad Magazine. Dear Alan, I think we're doing enough on Nixon and his war policies. We're doing everyday critical reviews, a housewife's meatloaf, a guy painting his house, an executive writing interoffice memos, a grammar school play, etc. You're offering us fragments as yet. I'll have to give you the form rejection henceforth.
Well, there you go. It was there was this poor guy, and I say poor guy because I badgered the life out of him. His name was Jerry DeFuccio, and he was the one who would field. There were a couple of associate editors. He was the one who I developed this correspondence with, and he was nice enough to go into the kind of detail that you just read. But when, he ended it by saying, basically, it's enough of this. I can't do this any longer. I'm going to send you the formed one.
How, I mean, you seem to be, you were good at writing jokes for the Catskill comics. The problem was the Catskills were pretty much dying out, right?
Well, you know something, the whole area, a couple of things were operative there. First of all, the area was dying out. This was in the early 70s after college. The Catskills' heyday, especially when it came to being a breeding ground for comedians, that was the 50s and the 60s. By the time I got there, all the also-rans, the guys who would not make it, were still there. And the reason that they weren't going to make it was because they were generic. All of them, none of them had distinct personalities. They were joke tellers. You know, it wasn't until years later when I started writing for guys like Rodney Dangerfield, who had that thing, I don't get no respect.
Right.
It was easier to have him say, even as an infant, my mother wouldn't breastfeed me. She said she liked me as a friend. Okay, that was easier to do because there was a character there.
Right.
So, you know, I learned joke writing up there, but once again, they were devoid of personality.
You, I'm curious of dealing with these various personalities over the year, and you talk about this throughout the book. But there's just because we're in the Catskills, so you're having this one point where you write a joke about the IRS, and you say, I'd written a joke about the economy being so bad that I just received a refund for my tax return, a check for $48 with a note asking if I could please hold it until Monday. And the comedian said, I'd change it to $49. You say, how come? And he said, it's a funnier number. That is brilliant.
That's the kind of nonsense I had to deal with. Okay.
but then you say you had a conversation years later with Richard Lewis?
No, it was David Brenner.
Oh, with David Brenner. But who were you with? You were with Billy Crystal?
I was with Adam Sandling. We were casting for our series, and we came to New York, and we went, hit some of the clubs to see if who was around and would anybody be good for our show, you know, to be either be in the cast or do a guest appearance.
Right.
And we went in, and I saw David Brenner. Now, David had was a good friend, and I hadn't seen him in a while. And unfortunately, he had since passed away, but he was always really good to me. And in the clubs, if you had somebody who was that accomplished, you know, David was a big star back then. He was, he guest hosted The Tonight Show, I think, more than anybody else. I mean, he was a big guy, and it was good to see him. He'd always been supportive, but he called me and Gary over, and he just told us confidentially that he figured out the funniest number. And I looked at Shandling, and then I looked at David. I said, well, you want to let us know what, you know, there's a lot of, he said, guess, that's what it was. And I said, you know, David, you know, it's, there's a lot of numbers. He narrowed it down a little bit. And then he looked around to make sure that nobody was eavesdropping on this, you know, this secret he just uncovered. And he whispered 267. And, you know, and I looked to him. I was hoping that he would wink. I thought that maybe there was a smile to let me know that he was kidding because he was a great practical joker. But I'm looking into this guy's face, and I'm going, he could very well be serious here.
Yeah.
And I remember when I wrote the book, Steve Martin wrote it. He gave me a really nice blurb for the book. But he got a hold of me about that number, 267. He couldn't believe it. And every so often, you know, even though the book came out months ago, I'll send Steve an email just with the number 267 and, you know, with the subject matter saying, just to brighten your day, you know.
So let me since we're talking about Gary Shandling, you and Gary Shandling, you were working on the show. Tell us how you came to meet him and work. I think that show, which I just went back and watched maybe 5 or 6 months ago, it was pandemic viewing for me. I certainly saw it and when it first ran, but to see it from start to finish again was just absolutely delightful. How did the two of you join forces? How aware were you of him before you were matched with him?
I was in New York. This was a few years after I left SNL. And I had a manager named Bernie Brillstein, who was very, very powerful manager. He managed Gilda and Belushi and Aykroyd and Jim Henson and the Muppets. And it just went on and on. Lorne Michaels. And he called me up and asked me if I knew who Gary Shandling was. And I said, yeah, I had seen him on The Tonight Show and Letterman and thought that he was a riot. Why? And
Did we lose Alan? I guess we lost Alan. I see. Okay, let's take a break. Wait, Mike and I are both looking at each other because all of a sudden Alan was talking and then he's not there. But when we look down at the phone line says that he is there. So I don't know, maybe he just pressed a mute button or something. So let's...
What's going on?
Oh, there you go. Okay, we lost you for a second. We couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm here.
All right, good. Yeah, we can hear you now. I didn't know if you got muted somehow, but you were talking and then you went away. Anyway, you're in New York. It's post SNL. They ask you if you had heard of Gary Shandling. You had.
Yeah, I had seen him on Letterman and on the Carson show, and I thought he was really funny. He was doing a special that needed a little help. They sent me the script. I thought I could be of help, and they flew me out and I helped with the special and he and I hit it off right away. And for me, it was like lightning striking again, because it was the same way as things had started with me and Gilda, you know, and I'm going, wow, I found another writing partner. And we wrote a pilot for this thing called It's Gary Shandling Show. And, it lasted 4 years. 72 episodes.
And it was I hate to use this term, I'm gonna use it anyway, but you broke that fourth wall, right? I mean, that was it was Gary just looking into the camera often and telling you what was going on. And I assume that was from the very beginning a style that you wanted to use.
Well, not only was it a style we wanted to use, we paid homage to the fact that George Burns had done it years before. You know, it was an old device, but Gary gave him a personal relationship with the audience in the studio and at home. But we went even further than breaking the fourth wall. We would drive a little golf cart from one set to the other. If he was going to have a memory, he went into a flashback booth. So what we did basically was we were doing a parody of a situation comedy while we were doing our own situation comedy.
You say you were intrigued by his persona.
I was very, very much so. He was self-deprecating, incredibly smart, and I can't even begin to tell you how many people who are very, very successful writers today, I will tell you that Gary Shandling taught them how to write. I can tell you that there's a part of me that I wake up 5:30 every morning to write whatever I'm working on. And there's on one shoulder, I've got Gary sort of watching me. And on the other one, I've got Gilda. And I try to basically go, okay, how would they like this? How would Gary say to do that? I think we all have certain people who are practical influences, in addition to being, you know, people that we admired. Gary was both. And Judd Apatow will tell you that Gary helped him, taught him how to write. Yeah. There's a writer named Ed Solomon who wrote Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
and he wrote the Men in Black series, movies. He was, Gary hired them to be him to be on our staff. There was a lot of people, and they feel like they owed not only their careers to Gary, but their craft.
And you think of that, Gary Shandling show, but then also then he went on to Larry Sanders. I mean, those are still just classic comedic programs.
Well, you know something, Larry Sanders, what's very interesting about that is I remember going out to eat with Gary after we ended our show. And he had been offered a ton of money to have his own talk show on Fox. Fox was this fledgling network, okay? And the first products that they actually had were reruns of It's Gary Shandling Show. They, I think Showtime had an exclusive on it for 30 days, and then I would edit them down to be, so they'd be shown on Fox, because we got frustrated that because not everybody had Showtime in those days. So we and Tracy Ullman were on at some like 10 o'clock on Sunday night as the package, two shows in a row. And so Gary, who had guest hosted The Tonight Show many times, was offered his own talk show on Fox. And he said to me, over dinner, he asked me what I thought. And I said, listen, man, I know that's a ton of money and all of that, but I don't think it's a good idea. I think that the way your brain works, that's the kind of show, that's the kind of genre you should be doing a satire of, doing a parody of behind the scenes of. I think you're going to grow bored asking celebrities questions about their new baby or where they went for Christmas and doing it legitimately. And, I'm not saying by any means that this influenced Gary, because he was the kind of guy who would ask 40 people the same, intimate question. There was a bunch of us who I'm sure had this conversation with him, but ultimately, he created Larry Sanders Show,
which was really a beautiful look at that genre, and just saying all the things that you just mentioned of all the concerns you had of just how difficult a thing it is, especially for somebody who is like Gary to do. But also, when he did The Tonight Show, when he would guest host The Tonight Show, it was brilliant. God, it was fun to watch.
Well, he was very unique, and he was, especially at that time, where there were a lot of joke tellers and very competent ones. Gary created a character, and he created, if you go back to the days of radio, legend has it that the longest laugh in the history of radio was Jack Benny. Okay. And it was out of silence.
Money
Jack
of your
Benny's
life, right?
Reputation, the character he created was a very, very cheap, miserly guy.
Right.
And on radio, they had a guy come up behind him with a gun in his back saying, your money or your life.
Right.
And he didn't say a word. And the more and more he kept on, and the more and more he was silent, the more and more the audience laughed. And when these laughs started to ebb, the bad guy said, well, and Jack Benny said, I'm thinking about it. Okay. So they knew that he was weighing, should I get my money or should I let him kill me? Gary was able to do that too. He would play the ineptitude of his women and his confusion. And he was basically uncomfortable in his body. And he pulled it off in such a way that he was be able to get laughs on nuance.
Yeah.
And that's a wonderful thing to achieve.
Let us talk in our remaining moments about the new movie Here Today. You work with someone that you've known for a very, very long time, Billy Crystal. And so give us a sense of how this project came about and what it, because it's based on a story you wrote.
Yeah, well, it's based on on a story that it was inspired by that a handful of years ago. I was the prize of a silent auction. Okay, people could bid on me to have lunch with me, and I think it was like a charity of some sort.
Who wouldn't want that?
Like Billy Chris. What's that?
Who wouldn't want that?
Yeah, who wouldn't want that? And I got friends like Billy Crystal where they'll pay $100,000 to watch him brush his teeth, you know? So I get my car. I live in New Jersey. I drove in, paid a toll, paid for parking, went to the restaurant. There was a young woman there who was the prize winner, you know? And I said, listen, I don't want to be indelicate, but how much did you spend to win this lunch with me? And she said, you know, 22. And I went, wow, that's not Larry David money or Billy Crystal money, but $2,200, that's pretty okay. And she goes, no, not $2,200, $22. I said, $22?
Wow.
She said, yeah, the bidding started at 20. It went up in 50-cent increments. So now I hate her, okay?
Yeah.
And we're eating, and she had ordered a seafood salad the size of my high school, all right? And she's chomping away on jumbo shrimp and lobster claws and oysters. And I look at her at one point, and one of her ears is turning a little red, and then an eye is starting to droop, and then her lips, her mouth is totally perpendicular to the floor. And she was having an allergic reaction to the seafood. And
right.
I'm sitting there going, wondering when does my obligation to this prize winner end? You know, how far do I got to go with this? My heart went out to her. I took her to Lenox Hill Hospital here in New York. She didn't have insurance. I bought her an EpiPen. So what cost her $22 cost me like $1,100. All right. I told that story anecdotally as a guest one night on the Letterman show. Billy was watching. He texted me and he said, why don't we make that the first scene between an older guy and a younger woman? And so let's see where it takes us, like a May-December relationship. So we started writing, and the character then evolved. We made him an older comedy writer. There was a man who was on SNL when I was there, and he was also there when Billy was there. Older guy than us. He was a mentor. His name was Herb Sargent.
Oh, yeah.
So we both had, and he was so well-respected.
Yeah.
I love the man. And so we made believe it was, you know, he was the prototype we wrote for. And then we took some elements from our own lives. My dad was starting to get dementia. Billy had an aunt with the same problem. And so we made it that this character, Herb didn't have it, but the character we now created, I was starting to have the onset of it. And he was writing a book about his deceased wife, and he was having trouble. And he meets this younger woman who at first there's a very deep friendship, and they have a lot of fun with each other. But when she sees what his problem is, she becomes his muse to help him complete the book. So it's very, very funny. Tiffany Haddish plays the young woman. Billy plays the older writer. And so you'll laugh a lot, you know, but at the end, people cry. So it's the kind of writing that Billy and I love doing. We did it when we collaborated on a one-man Broadway show that won a Tony Award called 700 Sundays.
Yeah. That was great.
You know, making people laugh and making them feel, you know, a whole gamut of emotions. I love that kind of comedy.
Alan Zweibel's new book is Laugh Lines. His new film, Here Today, is out tomorrow. Alan Zweibel, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much, and thank you for hopefully we can get you on sooner than five books from now.
Yes, thank you very much. I look forward to talking to you again soon. Thanks for having me.
Be well. Thank you. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.